Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today my guest is Dr. Eilish Gregory, and we're talking about her new book, just releasing this month with Boydell Press, titled Catholics During the English Revolution, 1642-1660, Politics, Sequestration, and Loyalty. Eilish, congratulations on your book, and thanks for joining me today on the show.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. Great.
Absolutely. Well, I was so glad to have gotten the chance to read this book, and I'm looking forward to hearing more from you about it. But before we do that, can you tell us some about your own background and maybe what led to your work on this project?
Yes, absolutely. So my background is in history. So I did my undergraduate and my MA degrees at the University of Kent, with my MA specializing in medieval and early modern studies. And I completed a PhD in history at University College London in 2017. And so this project, the book project as such, sort of sprung about from research I did during the PhD and then developed much further beyond the PhD, looking further into Catholic loyalty and the wider scope involving Catholics during this very important period in early modern British history.
Yeah, well, that's really terrific. And I'm really glad you've written this book, Eilish, because this is such a rich period in English history to draw from. So why don't we begin quite broadly with the title of your book? What was the English Revolution and how did Catholic sequestration fit into the story of revolutionary politics?
Absolutely. So the English Revolution is a term that's generally used to refer to the civil wars that occurred from 1642 to around 1651, though, as you can tell from the title of the book, I go to 1660, which was when the Charles II was invited back to England after the events of the Civil War, where he and his family went into exile. So the English Revolution as such is covering the Civil War period when Charles I was fighting against Parliament. So it was Royalists versus Parliamentarians. And then in the aftermath of when the King was executed and then when England was living into a period of republicanism. And so sequestration as such, and particularly Catholic sequestration, fits into this narrative quite well, in that sequestrations was used as a means to punish those who were deemed to be enemies of the of Parliament as such, so those who supported the Royalist cause, those who were believed to have caused the war as such, so Catholics or Papists as such, so those who are believed to be of Catholic origin but supporting, advocating as such the overthrow of royal rule as such and of liberty and the reformed religion. And so it sort of came about with that, and it continued to, even though it was generally used to punish those during the Civil War period as such, it continued to be used quite a lot during the Commonwealth period as well. And it just continued to evolve throughout this very intense 18-year period.
Well, now, what can you tell us of the history of sequestration and anti-Catholic penal law? Was this something that originated during the 1640s, or had it been a practice that dated back further, and was it something that was just expanded upon?
It's something that dated back way before the English Civil War. So its origins, sequestration had been around intermittently throughout much of the Middle Ages, but normally designed to punish those who were enemies as such. So we'll see this, you know, in the aftermath of the murder of Thomas Becket, for example. So it's used sort of very sporadically during the Middle Ages, but we see it really taking off in the 16th century after the Reformation and during the Elizabethan period. So it was designed to punish Catholics who were refusing to conform to Protestantism by absenting themselves from attending church every Sunday in their local parish church, or attending church on holy days and taking communion in accordance with the Church of England. And so we start to see legislation appear from around 1581 onwards, and then start to redevelop towards the end of Elizabeth's reign in 1593, and in the aftermath of the gunpowder plot, which occurred in 1605, but legislation appeared in 1606, designed to punish Catholics who were refusing to conform, but also those who were refusing to swear allegiance to the monarchy, and that the Pope had no right to absolve Catholics of their loyalty to the monarch and to overthrow them as such. So it had been in existence way before the Civil War period.
That's really helpful. Well, as we look to the decades ahead that your book addresses, during these periods of political change, heightened tension, you begin with two chapters that analyze the committees for sequestrations and for compounding, alongside the numerous acts and ordinances and orders that were passed by successive parliaments. Can you tell us, what did the Long Parliament mean for the sequestration in England? They created quite a bit of change, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. So I think what's really fascinating with the Long Parliament is that they really evolve how sequestration is run, because this all occurs in the early months of the Civil War. And so obviously Parliament is trying to deal with different fronts. They're trying to deal with fighting occurring in the north with Charles I and his Northern Army, and which Catholics are starting to be recruited in the army under the Earl of Newcastle. And they're also dealing with trying to confiscate lands from bishops, archbishops, those who they were deemed to be popish. So even though that they were members of the Church of England and Protestant, they believed that they were part of the chain of events which led to the Civil War. Because there's lots of factors which I cover in the introduction in the build-up to the Civil War. So you had the Bishops' War that occurred, then you had the Irish Rebellion. And so these were all contributing factors towards the English Revolution occurring. And so as a consequence, Parliament was trying to work out how to deal with all these broad enemies in as far-reaching ways as possible. And so one of the ways they decided to do that really was through sequestering, which is the term for confiscating the estates of people. So that's what they call the real and personal estates of people. So that's their land, their property, their personal goods, and their tenements if they're landowners and that sort of thing. And so we start to see from around late 1642, so just a few months after the Civil War started as such, with Parliament trying to work out which groups of people they should sequester estates from. And so by the time it comes to March 1643, which was when we start to see the ordinance passed at the very end of March, which actually stipulates all the different groups which are going to be sequestered. And so what's really interesting about the legislation is that it's not just including Catholics, but a lot of the attention goes towards those deemed to be enemies of Parliament. So we're talking mainly royalists, we're talking archbishops, bishops, deans and chapters, but Catholics are in there as well. And what's really fascinating really is that Parliament is obviously taking initiative of the original format that of sequestration that had been used against Catholics, but we're adapting it to suit their immediate need. And obviously back in 1642, 1643, they didn't think the war was going to last as long as it did. And so what's really fascinating is that you see this evolution happen from 1642 to 1648, where they're obviously trying to adapt as the war progresses. And then they have to try and deal with the aftermath of the when the First Civil War ended in 1646, on what to do with all these people who had fought against them, all the royalists. And then obviously this continued after the Second Civil War, which happened just for very briefly in 1648. And for those in the aftermath of the execution of Charles I, we have royalists at home and abroad trying to overthrow the Republican regime as such. And so you start to see, legislation towards sequestration continually evolve across this period, and with the enemies changing over time, depending on the situation at that particular moment.
Well, you go on to talk about the sequestration and the compounding process, how it was intended to work in the context of political messages put out by the current regime. Can you tell us, how did these messages and the new legislative measures affect the attitudes of citizens in the Commonwealth, particularly for how they viewed each other, either as friends or enemies?
I mean, it's really, really interesting question. Because obviously the rhetoric of sequestration acts, ordinances, is always very aggressive in a way, in that, if you're fighting against us, against Parliament, and obviously we're going to take all this away from you, it's going to be confiscated until you've paid your fines, or you've sworn these certain oaths of allegiance, whether it's the negative oath, the oath of engagement, oath of abjuration, etc. And obviously having terms like, saying who the enemies of the state is, essentially, which is, including Catholics, including royalists, that is quite a serious and quite an aggressive tone. But what's really interesting, and this kind of fits in what other Catholic historians have done for other parts of the early modern period in Britain, is that rhetoric versus practices is very, very different from each other. So even though you see officials carrying out their duties according to what they've been asked of them from the committees in London or from Parliament, at the same time, if it's known people in their communities, on the whole, they're generally quite kind to them, but obviously depending on how they get on with them to begin with, because obviously if you don't get on with your Catholic neighbour to begin with, you're not probably going to show any deference to them if they're being sequestered. But there's one really interesting example in the book where Penelope Gage from Hengrave Hall in Suffolk, her house has a night raid to take all her confiscate weapons from her house. And what's really not interesting about the letters that I looked at and which feature in the book is that the officials apologise for the night raid. They said, "We're really sorry to do this. We've been told from London we've got to do this, but we'll make sure that all your weapons aren't damaged and we'll take good care of them." And then they write a letter to Penelope Gage's mother shortly afterwards to apologise again for doing the raid. And so it gives you glimpses of how communities work, even within this environment, that even though they're having to follow guidance and legislation from London, at the same time, they will show kindness to Catholics who they trust and are friends with. I mean, people that they're going to encounter in their everyday lives. So yeah, it's been really, really fascinating research to do this across this period as well, because the 1640s and 1650s hasn't really been covered in English history from the Catholic perspective before. So it's really fascinating to just get glimpses of how Catholic and Protestant relationships worked for this very volatile period.
Yeah, it really is quite fascinating. And another issue that you bring up in the book is this issue of growing print cultures in the Civil War years and interregnum that really played no small part in the dissemination of political news. How did Catholics utilize the information that was being printed on the sequestration process?
That's a really good question. So what's really interesting in some of the county record papers that I looked at for some of these families is that you see how these different acts, ordinances, and sometimes pamphlets are being circulated across the country. And obviously, with the lapsing of the Print Licensing Act in at the start of the English Revolution, you start to see an explosion of print everywhere, and you start to see Parliament really utilising print to get their message across the country as such. And I cover this particularly in Chapter 3, in that official acts and ordinances are published within days of them being passed, and so it's a good way to try and get the message across. What I saw really in how we know that we can see how Catholics were utilizing this information in these official acts and orders and ordinances is by how they reference it in their petitions. So we see Catholics referencing quite a lot the article surrender for like Truro in Newark and in other places. So places where Catholics have been captured when they'd fallen into parliamentarian hands. And they're pretty much saying sometimes word for word what these orders are saying, which would have been printed or at least been handwritten and circulated to other Catholics. Obviously, manuscript circulations were still in operation alongside print in this period. But you also see occasionally in some county record offices as well, in depending on, because obviously some Catholic family records vary depending in abundance of records. So some will have hundreds and hundreds of documents, and some will have probably a couple of dozen manuscripts. But what's really interesting in these is when you see the printed versions, and you have handwritten marginalia where they've asterisked bits of the acts. And they've written notes next to it, so you can clearly see the thought process and how they're going to go about petitioning to get their estates back, or to how they should go about, trying to compound for their estates. So that's been really, really fascinating to see that and see how they're trying to work out themselves how to compound for their estates, because segregation and compounding really altered during the Civil War period. Because beforehand, Catholics just needed to admit that they hadn't gone to church. They pay a fine based on the estate's value, and then they just get a receipt at the end. Whereas now they're having to justify why they've been sequestered to begin with, why they should be allowed to compound for their estates, and then go through the evidences that they've done to prove that they should be able to compound. So it's really, really fascinating how it completely changes in this period.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And you brought up the petitioning. As we look more to the compounding process and Catholic experience, what you address near the middle of the book, what can you tell us of the main themes, the main arguments that were being used by Catholics in their petitioning? Or could you tell us something of the general structure of these petitions?
Yes, of course. So, as I've just mentioned a minute ago, that it generally follows all petitions, and it's not just Catholic ones, it's also like Royalist ones I've also looked at as well. They generally follow the same format, so say who they are, what their rank is, so obviously if they're a gentleman, if they're a peer, if they're a tenant or something like that. I mean, I generally looked at gentry Catholics, but obviously you do see occasionally other ones from lower ranking stating what their social status is as well. What they've been sequestered for. So have they been sequestered for recusancy, papist delinquency, or delinquency? And delinquency is referring to being a royalist in this case. So, but that's the term that they use in the petitions. And then they go do the explanation of why they think that they should be allowed to petition. So, if they've been sequestered for delinquency, they will either admit that they were fighting against the, for the roy they were fighting for the royalist cause. Or that they were in that garrison, but they weren't fighting against the parliamentarians, and they give reasons why. So whether it's because of they're there because of religious persecution or wrong place, wrong time, and also, if they're a Catholic, recusancy, that they admit that they are Catholic and they just, hadn't gone to church or hadn't conformed as normal. And then normally after that, they will say, I have taken the said oaths that have been required of them, whether they have paid the first half of their compounding fine or if they've done other remits which they've been asked to do in order to successfully compound for their estates and be discharged of their sequestration, because it's all about getting discharged from being sequestered. or having their estates confiscated, because obviously if it's confiscated, they can't live off that land, they can't have their goods back. So it's quite important to try and get their sequestration indictments discharged. And with the petitions, what's really fascinating is with the amount that I looked at probably over 1,000 petitions for this book from different Catholic families. And what's really fascinating is you start to see common themes cropping up throughout this whole period. So you get things mentioned like, oh, that they couldn't compound for their estates because there's been delays from the local county sequestration committees, or there's been corruption involved. So sometimes they might start accusing key figures in either the county sequestration committees or even in the committees for sequestration or for compounding in London, that they're not doing their duties diligently. But also you start to see other themes cropping up. So where they say that they've fled, that they were in royalist garrisons, for example, because they had fled religious persecution. So if soldiers were roaming the countryside and pillaging, that they obviously left their houses and went to seek safety, which would be the nearest fort stronghold, which in the case of some of them was a royalist stronghold. And so it's really interesting to see this similar themes cropping up. So I think what needs to be done more probably in the future on this is see, you know, is there some sort of like unofficial like guidebook that's going around for advice on how to do this? Because obviously the fact that they're saying the same thing over and over again suggests that they're following a very similar formula, which they would have had to have picked up along the way. So either through counsel or whether just through hearsay or just reading the acts and ordinances and just following and just working out for themselves that this is the format that they need to do. So it's been really, really fascinating just to see how it all works together really in these petitions.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, definitely. And I really appreciate how in this chapter you even go into their efforts to be creative and persuasive, even navigating and exploiting loopholes in their petitions. Another thing that you pick up in the fifth chapter, something that I find really interesting, when you're looking at the appeals made, especially to Parliament, is the Catholics' pursuit of legal counsel for guidance in their sequestration cases. Can you tell us how these correspondences, especially between family and state papers, they influenced your finding here for this fifth chapter?
Yes, of course. You often find in these types of petitions that you'll see references to the fact that they've sought counsel. So say, I sought counsel on this, but they don't name who the person is, which is quite frustrating, of course, because obviously you want to know who is the person they're approaching. Is there like a little network, or is everyone going to the same person? But what's really interesting, you really start to see this taking shape in the 1650s, so during the Republican era. And you can tell that Catholics and others, so it's not just Catholics, it's other people who are still reeling from the effects of sequestration and trying to compound for their estates in the 1650s, seeking legal counsel from the Inns of Court in London, so Gray's Inn and other inns there. And so you start to see more professional legal help, those who can try and see if there's anything to help them with to get their estates back, or to try, you know, lessen the fines, or to try and just get the estates back. And two key figures that crop up quite a lot in the Catholic estates were two figures, so Gilbert Crouch and John Rushworth. And John Rushworth, for those who may be familiar with early modern history, is famous for his for being a historian later in life and writing his book about this period just towards the end of the 17th century. And what's really fascinating with these two men is that they're purchasing really vast estates, particularly in the north of England, of Catholic and Royalist estates. And they're doing this to not only because at the request of the families or from their wider family asking for them to help their relatives who have been sequestered, but they're also, you know, living off these estates as well. So John Rushworth was living off the rents of these lands, you know, from lands like the Constables and other places, other families in Yorkshire and in Northumberland, but also Gilbert Crouch in Lancashire and Yorkshire was doing the same as well. But they clearly had quite a good relationship with them. I mean, what was quite interesting with looking at Gilbert Crouch, for example, in the Lancashire Record Office with the Blundell family, which is a very famous family that is used quite a lot by Catholic historians for this period, is that in the accounts books there, it's really fascinating. You see the copies of the letters that he sent to Gilbert Crouch, and then Nicholas Blundell and William Blundell, for example, are really thankful for all the help that Gilbert Crouch is doing. Like he's sending them copies of stuff from London about their estates, and you know they're saying, you know, when you've sorted this out, you know, here's a bit of money as a reward for what you've done. And so it's something that needs to be studied in a lot more detail, because I mean the problem with legal counsel is that obviously because they're trying to protect estates, they're not trying to leave a paper trail at the same time. So the fact that I managed to see glimpses of this through Rushworth and Crouch through a couple of families was really fantastic, because again, they're, you know, these lawyers are clever enough to try not to leave a paper trail, because otherwise if they get caught, which Rushworth does at one point, you know, it's going to have repercussions for them about their dealings as such. And so I think this what my chapter raises, I hope, is just scratches the surface. I think there needs to be a whole big project on this, and I have looked more into legal counsel and lawyers for the other research I'm doing at the moment, because you start to see it becoming really more professionalized from the late 17th century onwards. And so I think that this is where we start to see the beginnings of this really taking shape in becoming professionalized in helping Catholics, and for lawyers to help, you know, to make money out of this for professional and legal reasons in helping Catholics protect their estates.
Yeah. Well, Catholics were living in such a peculiar, remarkable position, as you say, during these years. Now, we've talked about the efforts to compound their property, talked about, or this is something you speak about in the book, being excluded from the Toleration Act in the 50s, but at the same time, not punished for recusancy for a time. The interregnum brought in constant debate about toleration, it seems, public debate about toleration, that is. How much did Catholics participate in the debates on toleration and liberty of conscience?
Yeah, I mean, Catholics were quite active participants, and quite a lot of work is being done on this by Irish historians. And there's a historian, Christopher Gillett, in America, who is actually doing quite a lot on this about Catholics and the oaths of allegiance, and in debates surrounding how Catholics should show their allegiance to, whether it's Parliament or to the Stuarts in this period. So there's quite a lot of work on this at the moment. But what's really interesting is that, because I think before people knew that these sort of discussions were happening, but they weren't really looking into how this is affecting Catholics' perspectives on how to, you know, obviously to protect their estates, but also how to really think about themselves as you know, English subjects, but also as loyal subjects, but also while not denying their Catholic faith. And so you start to see quite a lot of Catholic factions appearing. So you have the Black Lawyers, for example. So there's been quite a lot of work done over the years on the Black Lawyers by Stefania Tutino in particular. And you start to see groups abroad, you know, in the exiled Stuart court, for example, having these discussions about, you know, if we continue to try and get the Stuarts back, you know, to England, what's it going to mean for Catholics when we come back? You know, are we going to have toleration? You know, can we have an alternative oath than before, for example? And in the 1640s, there were different alternative oaths of allegiance being bandied about. And again, this is something that Thomas Clancy and Christopher Gillett have done work on. And it just shows really that Catholics were active participants in trying to define themselves as Catholic and loyal English subjects. And again, this with sequestration, this kind of throws this into perspective as well, because obviously by petitioning, for example, the fact that a lot of them are starting to use in the 1650s the fact that they were religious victims of the war to justify their loyalty to the state is really, really fascinating, because sometimes you'll see, you know, I'm loyal to Parliament, I'm loyal to my country, but I was only that Royalist garrison for my own safety because of religious persecution as such. So they're not trying to deny their Catholicism as such, but they're trying to, at the same time, demonstrate that they're not disloyal. Because obviously since the Reformation, and particularly in the aftermath of the Gunpowder Plot, there's always that question of, are Catholics loyal subjects? Can they both be loyal English subjects and also be Catholic in a way? So you see these debates really coming about in the 1650s, but there's no complete unified voice on it, because you've got all these different Catholic groups. I mean, it's almost like the Protestant groups as such. You've got all these different Protestant groups springing up and having similar types of debates happening. And Catholics are just the same. They're not completely unified on what's the best path forward in their loyalty. So it's really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most insightful aspects of your research, because you're challenging the idea that Catholics were isolated here, but rather they're actually active in their engagement with the conversations and debates about their future. Well, Eilish, as we're wrapping up now, can you tell us something of the application you think this book will have on the broader studies of 17th century Britain?
Yes, definitely. Because I mean, the Civil War and the English Revolution such has never gone out of fashion in history. But I think what's quite unique about the book is that it's for the first time really telling the story from the English Catholic perspective, because it has been like mentioned in passing sometimes, but no one's really looked at this in detail and really considered the questions before of how do Catholics define their loyalty? How do Catholics deal with the war and sequestration, but which I'd had to deal with before? How do they adapt to change, and how do they, consider themselves as in this very chaotic world that's occurring around them? And this is and I think this fits in quite a lot with work that's been done, as I said before, in Ireland, by Irish historians. So you see a lot of historians like by Francis Nolan, for example, and Targa Henrahan, John McCafferty, and others really looking at this from the 1640s and 1650s from the Irish perspective. So this is actually, in a way, going to help see the commonalities and differences are occurring, and maybe this might work out to be a much bigger debate and question about, you know, how do we look at Catholics as a whole for this whole period across Britain. But I think this also fits in with work that's been done before by other historians who do similar themes that I do. So in the works of John Bossy, for example, for his very famous work, The English Catholic Community, in Michael Kessier's work, who's looked at the Catholic perspective on for early modern England from the 16th century to the early 17th century, but also in the works of Alexandra Walsham and in Gabriel Glickman, who actually looks more into the Catholic community for the up to the mid 18th century. So I think this actually sort of fits in together, like how the broader period of how do Catholics generally survive and adapt in England and later Britain from the Reformation up to the end of the 18th century. So I think it will slot in quite nicely, and also just help answer the questions that people have not really looked at before for this very sort of very strange two decades where it's been a bit of a black hole before.
Well, I think you've made a really valuable contribution to the historical work on the Commonwealth, the interregnum, and especially how we think about English Catholic communities in early modern life. And you've also provided a pretty meaningful backdrop for and context for scholars of English Catholicism who would inspect the decades later, subsequent decades in English life and politics. Before we go, Eilish, can you tell our listeners what you plan to work on next?
Yes, of course. Before the pandemic, I have been for the last couple of years broadening out the long-term effects of sequestration and the long-term discussions of Catholic laity evolving with politics and sequestration up to the mid-18th century. So looking at the longer period, and also just sort of going back to the early foundations of sequestration as such. So I've had a few library fellowships, which have given me the opportunity to sort of do testers in different places to see if there's, again, if there's any commonalities occurring. So I've done research in at the Folger, for example, and also in Dublin and in Durham as well. And so I've seen, as I mentioned earlier, that how lawyers and counsel have really started to become professionalized and become much more heavily involved in helping Catholics with their estates from the late 17th century onwards. And again, how Catholics are adapting their petitions and their language to get their estates back at certain periods. There's a really, I think it's quite an amusing petition from in the aftermath of the first Jacobite Rebellion. So this is just towards 1720, I think, when Catholics are complaining that they haven't been given enough time to compound their estates as such, because they did it by calendar month rather than by lunar month or something, which I think is quite amusing. And they're getting right down to the nitty gritty timings by the moon and when they could petition or to at least be allowed to compound their estates because they missed the deadline or something. And what I want to do, and I think there's general good scope for it, is to look at sequestration and Catholic laity through the themes that I talk about in the book, to look at it from across Britain and Ireland, but also in the American colonies and Caribbean as well, because a lot of Catholics obviously go to America as well, and we see a lot of Irish Catholics in the Caribbean as well, like in the Leeward Islands and in Montserrat. And so you start to see Catholics also appealing to lawyers in Britain as well. And also, you know, Catholics who have lands in America going, can you protect my estates? Because sometimes their estates will get sequestered. So obviously there's a famous example of Lord Baltimore having to appeal to Cromwell in the 1650s because his estates are being jeopardized in Maryland. And obviously Cromwell gets involved in that and goes in the favor of Lord Baltimore, even though he's, in the eyes of many in the area, a notorious Catholic. And I'm actually writing a piece involving an 18th century Protestant lawyer called Edward Northey, who's helping Catholics with their estates in the Leeward Islands and who's heavily involved in the border trade. So I think there's definitely big scope for it. So I'm hoping one day, if finance, you know, when the archives open again, and if there's the scope to have it as a funding project, to actually really look into this in great detail and just to generally see how this all operates across this really vast and important period. And especially, you know, as Britain is expanding as well, because obviously this would be in the context of Britain emerging as a empire as well.
Very good. It all sounds really interesting, and we'll look forward to seeing the fruits of some of that research in the days ahead. But for now, thank you so much for writing this book, Catholics During the English Revolution, 1642 to 1660. And Eilish, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you. And thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network.